Hello. On this week's program, we look at a new exhibition that shows how local artists have reinterpreted a Japanese childhood tradition. Susan Lewis checks back with contestants in the Project 21 film competition as they near the end of their three-week-long production schedule. Jason Pfeiffer explores the popularity of jukebox musicals and visits the Delaware Theatre Company in Wilmington as they stage Sam Cooke, Forever Mr. Soul. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we visit the Shoe Museum at Temple University. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
In the beginning of the school year, children are often asked, "What did you do on your summer vacation?" The conversation takes a small amount of class time and is a way for teachers to get an idea of who's in their classroom. In Japan, school children have a somewhat more involved assignment. On the last day of school, each child is given a blank journal. In that journal, they're expected to record what they did on every day of their 40-day-long summer vacation. Not just through writing, but in pictures as well. On the first day of the new school year, the teacher will take a page from each journal to hang on the wall. For Hiro Sakaguchi, this elementary school project helped shape his future.
You kind of forced to draw something, and you kind of realize, I like drawing, so...
30 years have passed since Hiro's school days, and he now lives and makes art in Philadelphia. His latest project, based on these pictorial journals, is part of a show at the Center for Emerging Visual Artists, a non-profit organization dedicated to helping artists with their careers. Hiro is an alum of the center's 2-year career development program, a program designed to give artists exhibition opportunities, plus some of the practical and business tools that are often overlooked in art schools. The current show is part of the center's annual visiting curator program. This year's emerging curator is Sean Stoops. His show is called Subterrane and focuses on maps, not maps that point east or west, but more about personal routes, as Stoops explains.
How they record their either histories or memories or imaginary experiences or real experiences in terms of travel and their families, paths of their life, that their lives have taken.
This is where the picture journals come in. Hiro gave 24 artists a blank page from a Japanese picture journal. The top of the page is for drawing, the bottom for writing. Along the side is a thermometer to record the day's temperature and 2 clocks to mark waking and sleeping hours. For Hiro, the journals are a map of both his past and his present.
Telling you that I'm from Japan, I'm able to communicate those people. And kind of show how trace of my life, past 15 years. Because the first time I came to this country, I didn't speak English.
He smiles at the result of the project, remarking that the display is very similar to the one the teacher would hang on the classroom wall. Only this, for him, is another part of his personal map. These are his friends, his fellow artists. This is all a part of who he is now. Hiro includes some of his own journal entries in the show. There's a drawing of a childhood memory where he falls off the steep Japanese-style roof of his parents' house while gazing at the stars. In the writing, he remarks that he sometimes sees the same constellation from his Philadelphia home, reminding him of the boy he once was. Sheriff Hibachi is one of the artists Hiro asked to create a picture journal. Hibachi, who focuses most of his energies on painting, says this assignment forced him to step out of his usual routine.
I found the format really interesting. Growing up, I never really had that kind of an assignment. You have to draw and write in the same format. I thought it was pretty intriguing. And it's something that I thought it would just let me try something new and different.
Hibachi did not take the project literally. His drawings of animals, plants, and an enchanted forest are more like a dream journal. But Hiro says this is fine. He wanted to allow each artist to interpret the journals in their own way. Hiro also says creating fantasies fits into his own experience of the picture journal project.
Because I made a fictional paper because I was a kid. I didn't go anywhere, but I forgot what I did. Assignment is due. You have to make up. Say, I went to Mount Fuji yesterday, or something like that. Or I remember my friend every day she's some really nice place. She's like, I went to this beach, I went to this place. We found out she was totally faking it. Everything was fictional picture journal. And I think it's nice to have even fictional picture journal, you know, it's kind of way to escape.
Subterrane runs through December 21st. The Center for Emerging Visual Artists is at 237 South 18th Street in Center City, Philadelphia. 2 weeks ago, we reported on a new Philadelphia Film Festival that had launched its first filmmaking competition. Project 21 gave 21 film teams 21 days to write and produce a 10-minute long film. At the launch 3 weeks ago, festival producers announced that there would be a secret element that every film was required to incorporate into its story. That secret element was also 21. Filmmaking teams dispersed, some set on live action, some animation, and some a combination of the two. As the competition entered its final week, WRTI's Susan Lewis visited one of the sets to see how the filmmaking was going.
Standing in the back room of a gallery in Old City, this is where the artists work. But tonight, it's been transformed into a film set for Go Sono Productions, filming 21, its entry in the film competition, Project 21. Right now, everyone's been kicked out of this room except two actors, the director, the assistant director, the lighting guy, the sound guy, and us. This crew is trying to do what 20 other groups of filmmakers are also attempting, to make a film from beginning to end in 21 days. Most are working in this region, but the film competition's organizers, Stephanie Yuhas, Matt Conant, and Kwang Lee, say they have contestants as far away as Hawaii and Japan. Technology and the internet have made it easy to spread the word. But even with this new technology, what kind of films will be made in 21 days? Yuhas says at the start they were expecting all genres.
We're going to get a couple comedies. We're going to get a couple documentaries. We have an experimental filmmaker. We have a lot of people blending live action and animation, which is fantastic. We have horror people. We don't want to force anyone to make a film they don't want to make. We just want to inspire them and motivate them to make the film that they've been meaning to make.
The production we're watching now will eventually add animation to the live action. At the helm of its crew is Genevieve Okupniak, project leader and director. The Go in Go Sono. The team is, in fact, a sister act. Genevieve, the director, is the eldest. Natalie, the screenwriter, is the youngest. In the middle is So, Stephanie, the actress, who admits that this trio of complementary talents in the same family, in the same business, is wacky in a wonderful kind of way.
It's bizarre, is what it is. Ever since I can possibly think of it, my mother can totally back me up on this one. My eldest sister and I have always wanted to do films. The moment my parents bought a camcorder, my older sister was behind it, and I was running around in front of it singing and doing all sorts of strange things. And then it wasn't until late high school that my youngest sister, Natalie, really decided that she loves writing. I mean, she's normally the one in the background holding the microphone and telling me, oh, that outfit looks horrible, wear something else. And now she's writing my lines, and she's fantastic at it.
This is the first time the three have worked together on a film, taking turns with its creation like relay runners handing off a baton. First, Genevieve picked the location. And then, with the project launch and the announcement of the secret element, the race and the pressure were on. On Natalie the writer in particular, at least in that first week. Because the fanciest technology available is of little use without a good story to tell.
It was extremely difficult. There was so much pressure put on me for a small period of time because everyone needed the script before they could start the project at all. You have to take the major elements of writing a screenplay, like an inciting incident or a midpoint, a climax, resolution, the basic elements of any story, and try to fit them quickly into just 10 minutes, and that's all, page per element almost.
Once complete, the script and the tension shifted to Stephanie, the actress, to learn her lines, and Genevieve, the director, to pull the production team together.
Natalie finished the script. She sent out the script on Sunday. Stephanie arranged getting the gallery on Tuesday. And then on Tuesday, when I knew we had the space, I called everybody, said, what are you doing on Sunday? They said, nothing. I said, good. I have you all day. Today we're shooting, and we're going to spend the rest of the week editing and animating.
My name is Ryan Sullenberger. I'm the DP, the director of photography on the film. my job is actually handling lighting, the camera, and everything in between.
My name is John Woods. I'm doing sound. It means I'm going to hold the microphone now and make sure that we're getting good sound on tape. And then after today, when we start doing post, I'm going to treat the sound and make sure it, you know, sounds good. Cut it up, get rid of any bad noises or things like that,
yeah.
Like bags rustling and errant footsteps and things of that sort. If there's going to be any music involved, I'll take care of that.
Every film is different, and each production schedule has its own wrinkles and roadblocks. Team Gosono had a family issue that knocked out some days in the first week. Team Manlet, made up of Drexel students, had to work around classes and pre-planned Thanksgiving weekend trips home. When last we checked, Team Torres was working on its animated film scattered across Philadelphia and parts of New Jersey. Project 21 is itself a part of a larger independent filmmaking scene in what is a growing film culture in the region. Temple University English professor Oliver Geiken this year founded the Philadelphia Cinema and Media Seminar to foster collaboration and spark creativity, first among film academics, but also among local filmmakers.
Traditionally, there's a divide between people who study film and people who make it. Frequently, there's not a lot of communication between the two areas. They're seen as coming from different traditions. But in fact, the way that we're thinking about the cinema and media seminar is that those distinctions are not really so crucial. We don't want to define ourselves by saying, well, we're only interested in the study of film and not the production side.
Project 21 producers Conant, Juhas, and Lee created the festival to bring together filmmakers, much in the same spirit as the cinema and media seminar brings together film scholars. Professor Geiken says this networking is an important ingredient to growth in film culture and the film business.
Festivals are crucial, and the more that sort of thing is going on, the better it is for what we're doing, even though the connections may only be indirect, initially at least.
Meanwhile, back on the set, Gosono director Genevieve Okupniak is making sure every detail is ready for the shoot. They're filming the last scene first, so the extras can work and go home. Stephanie, her character and artist with dark designs, looks glamorous in makeup and a silk Asian mini dress. Her male co-star is sitting half-naked on a stool, decorated with tiny lights, a face mask, and a lampshade on his head. We're told we'll get it when we see the film, the title of which, by the way, happens to also be 21. And no matter what happens with the competition, Genevieve says this project and its deadlines have helped her realize a vision.
This has always been a dream of ours, for the three of us to actually work together and get it together. And when I heard about Project 21, I said, this is the perfect opportunity for us to just do it. Let's just stop talking about it and just do it.
It's now 21 days since Project 21 launched. This evening, the teams will drop off their finished films. Public screenings of all the entries will be on Monday and Tuesday, December 4th and 5th, at the International House Theater at the University of Pennsylvania. Audience members and a panel of judges will vote on the top films. Then on January 24th, a DVD compilation will be released, and top honors will be awarded for various categories, including Best Actor, Director, Cinematographer, and of course, Best Film.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. In the world of Broadway, a new category of shows has emerged in recent years. They're called jukebox musicals, productions that create a musical narrative with pre-existing popular songs. The next show at the Delaware Theatre Company in Wilmington loosely falls under the label of a jukebox musical. To explore the nature of this theatre trend a little more, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer recently visited the creator and director of the Delaware Company's latest production and reports that the jukebox brand calls for a delicate balancing act.
While working on an entirely different production, playwright and director Kevin Ramsey sat in the rehearsal hall of the Delaware Theatre Company about this time last year, reading a New York Times review of the book Dream Boogie by Peter Guralnick. It's a biography of the famous soul singer Sam Cooke. Ramsey says that thinking about the drama and impact of Sam Cooke's life, which we'll touch on in just a moment, sparked the idea of writing a show about the singer. In just a year's time, that spark has evolved into a one-man musical, Sam Cooke, Forever Mr. Soul.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
A native of Mississippi, Cooke's life was both remarkable and tragic. During the 50s and 60s, 29 of his songs hit the top 40 chart. Chain Gang, Twistin' the Night Away, You Send Me, and Wonderful World are just a few of them. What a wonderful world this would be. But in 1964, at the age of 33, Sam Cooke was shot to death in a Los Angeles motel. While there's still a debate about what exactly transpired at the motel, few question Cooke's influence on the music business. Kevin Ramsey explains that the singer, writer, and producer was a pioneer in a variety of ways.
Sam Cooke, who, during and being part of the civil rights movement, was a young artist who said, "I will own and control that in which I create." So at a time when African-American recording artists were either being ripped off or didn't reap the benefits of their artistry, Sam Cooke said, "No, if I create it, then I own it." And we're talking about publishing. That's where really in the music industry the money is. You can even be a writer and not own your own publishing. So he understood that. He was one of the first to say, "I refuse to place in segregated audiences." So his short life was imbued with such a fiery vision. And it was simple. It wasn't like he was out beating the drum. He was simply just doing what he loved, and that was writing, singing, producing, and creating music.
Even though his life was full of drama, any show about Sam Cooke would be remiss to not include music from the artist. And Forever Mr. Soul indeed features performances of many songs that Cooke recorded, songs that one might find in a jukebox. This trait puts the musical in the company of some recent Broadway hits and flops that also incorporate some jukebox tunes. Imported from London, Mamma Mia, whose storyline features the music of the 1970s Swedish pop group ABBA, opened on Broadway in 2001. The musical is often credited with paving the way for the recent surge of Broadway jukebox musicals, although it was not the first to use the formula. On the heels of Mamma Mia's success, Broadway producers began staging a string of shows with a similar format, creating musical scores with catalogs of popular song hits. The results have been mixed. For example, Good Vibrations, inspired by the Beach Boys, Lennon, based on the music of John Lennon, and Ring of Fire, a nod to Johnny Cash, all had a short lifespan. Meanwhile, musicals like Movin' Out, which features the music of Billy Joel, and Jersey Boys, which centers around the songs of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, have proven to be big crowd pleasers. In Kevin Ramsey's opinion, producers are eager to produce these kind of shows because the works have a built-in hook.
You already have music that's familiar. So as opposed to having a composer having to, like a Stephen Sondheim, like a Cy Coleman, having to engage the audience's ear in something that is new and unfamiliar, this whole idea of jukebox musicals from the inception and conception of is that you have music that's already known and familiar to the ear.
Ramsey says that this sort of connection is especially appealing from a marketing standpoint. Marjorie Samoff, the president and producing director of Philadelphia's Prince Music Theater, agrees that there's great value in using recognizable songs in musicals.
I think these shows, when they're successful, create a feeling of community because of the shared appreciation of the music.
Samoff hopes that the Prince Theater can tap into this sort of broad appreciation in February as they stage the world premiere of Stormy Weather, a jukebox musical about the life and music of Lena Horne. But Samoff says that Stormy Weather and musicals like it will usually only succeed with a strong storyline, the drama, if you will. She explains that this is a tall order when working with music that wasn't written for theater.
A pop song and a theater song are two very different animals. If you think about it, a pop song is meant to catch your attention immediately on the radio of 10 seconds, you know, and they have to grab you. And usually has one idea, variations on a theme, perhaps a verse and then a et cetera. But a theater song has to start the character at point A and take that character or that situation on a journey and end somewhere else. So it's a very different thing.
Without a solid story, Samoff views the jukebox musical as little more than a concert or a glorified musical review, which on the surface might suit some people just fine, but Temple University theater professor and artistic director Doug Wager explains that combining popular songs with a weak plot can actually do more harm than good because then the show is usually forced to live up to the high standards of the original pop songs, a high bar for the average Broadway cast.
The audience comes with a lot of personal memories and personal history attached to the original versions of those songs. And unless it's a whole different story where the audience is able to kind of reconnect the music to the story that's being told on stage and disconnect from their own memory of the music, as much as you are getting them in the door because of the music, they're not feeling satisfied by what happens on stage because it can never really live up to their memory of the music.
With Sam Cooke, forever Mr. Soul, creator Kevin Ramsey felt compelled to write the show because he thought Cooke's life was a fascinating story. In fact, while he doesn't dispute that his show could be considered part of the jukebox musical genre, he prefers to call the work a play with music, putting emphasis on the story, not just the tunes.
This piece, the music is woven in a way into the text and the body of the words. It's about the man's life more so than the man's songs.
Nonetheless, Ramsey says that childhood memories of his parents dancing to Sam Cooke's music helped make the Forever Mr. Soul project especially appealing to him. And therein seems to lie the delicate balance that a successful jukebox musical should strike. The show needs to effectively use the popular music, because that's often what gets people in the door. But if you want people to stay in their seats until the final curtain, it must also spin a darn good yarn.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Sam Cooke, Forever Mr. Soul, opens at the Delaware Theatre Company in Wilmington on December 9th and runs through December 24th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
These new shoes, they make me walk so slow. New shoes, oh, they ache at every toe. Honey, I'm never going to choose another pair of brand new shoes.
At Temple University's School of Podiatric Medicine is a museum dedicated to the objects that will give these future foot doctors most of their clients, the shoe. No one is quite sure when or where shoes were invented. The oldest model in the museum is a pair of Egyptian burial sandals dating back to 200 BC. Barbara Williams, the curator of the Shoe Museum, showed us a collection that would make even Imelda Marcos green with envy.
We have the most unique feet of any species on the planet. They do everything for us. They're very, very complex, and they turn and they jump and they, you know, they're wonderful. And we think they're ugly, and we think they're too big, and we think they're funny looking, and we pay no attention to them, or we turn them into whatever fads around and put on them whatever looks nice. And if it hurts, well, that's all right. We'll just take it off later, you know. And this is half the reason anymore that we have major foot problems.
The exhibit begins in the lobby of the school, where Ella Fitzgerald's gold go-go boots are resting in a display alongside original sheet music and photos of Lady Ella. Amongst the other more than 900 pairs of shoes on display, the pumps of First Ladies Nancy Reagan, Lady Bird Johnson, and Mamie Eisenhower. There's also a pair of sneakers that once belonged to Dr. J and the cowboy boots of Robert Mitchum. But the museum is not just a showcase for the footwear of the rich and famous. Many historic shoes also provide a glimpse into the past. Barbara Williams shows us a typical pair from a simpler time.
These on the other side are here for another purpose. Those happen to be, and you can tell it, left shoes, right? Which foot are these? They are absolutely straight. They are called straights, and they existed well through, even though these are very early 19th century. There was a long, long period where they made no right and left shoes. And by 1822, they could make pairs of last, but nobody cared. Nobody bothered. Apparently, the beginning of the change was the Civil War, and they decided they better do something better for the soldiers. So they got out the equipment and made pairs of boots.
There's also a whole case dedicated to the satin point shoes of the ballerina, as well as paintings of shoes and painted on shoes. A favorite of curator Williams is a drawing of a pair of ornate boots.
Just to illustrate an interesting point, and I think it's a fun point, namely what we've done to the male image. Because if you think back to Shakespeare, Henry VIII, who had the laces and the pastel colors and the satins and the flowers and the frills and the first little heels, in fact, was men. And then women very quickly got into the act. And the men just disappeared. And here you see a whole case of brown and black shoes, and unless you're a teenager or a rock star, that's about as far as you ever get.
The exhibition passes through the ages and across the oceans. Cases are devoted to the bound feet of Chinese women and the delicately embroidered 3-inch shoes that protected them. The Shoe Museum displays everything from fetish designs to more practical footwear. As Barbara Williams more prosaically puts it, the museum displays the many ways people have found to keep their feet from touching the ground.
Dancing on daddy's shoes. Dancing on daddy's shoes. Dancing all around the room. Rolling the rug up, kicking our heels up, dancing on daddy's shoes.
It's said that Mozart could write a symphony while playing billiards, but Philadelphia Daily News arts writer Tom DiNardo says composing's not so easy for mere mortals.
For the uninitiated, composing seems a very romantic pursuit, a creator pouring the guidance of a muse onto paper. But actually, it's the loneliest of professions, and one of the least satisfying. A painter or a writer can at least show work to friends, but the work of a composer doesn't even exist until it gets a performance. A successful composer lucky enough to receive commissions has to create to a deadline, whether the ideas flow or not. And a hopeful one may never discover if his work is even worthy enough to be played. Until recently, Felix Mendelssohn is the only composer in history who didn't have to write music to put food on his table. Even Stravinsky didn't receive international fees from his Firebird, Petrushka, or The Rite of Spring until he came to America 30 years later and made slight changes to begin the copyright anew. Composing is a curse in a way, and when I asked a composer friend why he went through such stress, his answer was, "It's my only aptitude." There's also the specter of some unusual historical ends. Jean-Baptiste Lully, who conducted by banging a cane on the floor, struck his own foot and eventually died of gangrene. Mstislav Karlovitz was buried in an avalanche on a ski trip. Krumpholz threw himself into the Seine and drowned when his wife ran off with his rival, Dussek. Charles-Marie Alcan was reaching for a copy of the Talmud when a shelf of Jewish religious books fell over and crushed him. Granados' ship in the English Channel was torpedoed by a German Navy boat, and Granados drowned after jumping from a life raft to save his wife. And Anton von Webern went outside to light up a cigarette and was shot by an American soldier, one day after the German armistice. Between the ages of 33, the cruel lifetime of Schubert, and the 39 years of Chopin, you can count Bellini, Bizet, Gershwin, Weber, and birthday boy Mozart, who lived only to a mere 35. Then there's Beethoven, whose skull was found to be full of lead, the same affliction that is supposed to have made all the Roman emperors insane from drinking wine from lead goblets. Even when well-known in Vienna, the difficult Beethoven was constantly scrambling to make a living. So it's hard to know if he would have experienced rage or satisfaction from the recent discovery of an incomplete manuscript of his thorny Grosse Fuge, found last fall at the Palmer Theological Seminary on City Line Avenue. It was sold at auction. The winning bid? $1,950,000.
Philadelphia Daily News arts writer Tom DiNardo. And that's it for now. Our program, written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Amy Watson Bish and Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.